to us to work with us in 69. They had Dr. Flukey and came to ACS headquarters in Washington. I'll never forget it. And they made a proposition to us to cooperate on development, further development. And we agreed to do that, to do the R&D necessary to build the systems for them. We decided that we also need to make this offer to the British. If we are going to do work this way under a cooperative agreement with the Germans, then we also should make the same agreement with the British if they want it. Now, there was 10 different scientific societies in England, like the Institute of Chemical Engineers and the Food and Drug, and there were 10 different societies, and we didn't see how we were going to work with 10 different scientific societies in England to help them provide chemical information. So we said to the British, you get your act together. We want to work with one group. You decide what group. And the Royal Society of Chemistry was formed out of this edict to them, to one group. We don't care which one we want to work with. Tony Kent, we had been working with him, which was under Chemical Society, but three of the scientific, well, all 10 of them got together then to decide to work with the Chem Royal, and they changed their name from the Chemical Society to the Royal Society of Chemistry. And I would think I was made an honorary member of the Royal Society of Chemistry just based on that, and forced them to work together in England to develop the chemical information systems. They also, and I don't know if you know this, but there were 5 different groups in England that wanted to develop computer-based systems for all of England, for all of scientific information. The government, commercial, Pergamon, and the scientific societies. There were 5 different groups, and they wanted to form a British online computing center for the network. But they got into serious trouble trying to get commercial and private and government and scientific societies to work together. And so that experiment folded. And they lost quite a bit of time and money. They tried to write their own software, and they got Battelle to use Battelle software. But that didn't work out for them to set up an online system for service to England. The French was different. The French Commission came to us and said we'd like, certain French did. They had a great chemist doing coding, notations, at the University of Paris. Gosh, I shouldn't forget his name. He had developed systems, and very, very good guy. They were going to use that for the CNRS information programs, and they were going to compete with us. And they wanted to use us especially. They wanted to compete on the notation systems and the chemical reaction systems. Quite a good guy. Anyhow, they said CNRS was trying to set up a national system for all of their information science, scientific information program. And the Chemical Society people said, well, we'd like to help you do it for the chemistry profession in competition with the system in France. And they did at the Chemical Society building there. And it worked out pretty good for a number of years. They were selling, marketing, and setting up a computing system based on our system. But then it went kapoop. The didn't make the money necessary to, and they couldn't get government support because it was in competition with the own program over there. And so it didn't get ever get the support, and then he went kaput. Japan was different, completely different. They, Japanese was trying to set up their own system. I don't know if you know, but it's about 28% longer, or maybe it's 18% to write in kanji and kana. Have you ever seen a Japanese writer, chemical typewriter, yeah, or computer keyboard? And all those pictograms, 2,800 of them, and it takes longer, more words, more than it does. English is shorter, and there are a lot of scientific people in Japan that don't read English, although most of them now read English and even write in English. Half of, I think, all the Japanese scientists write English now. They didn't used to. Most of them understood and could read English, but they were trying to set up their own system, the government-operated system called JIST, Japan Information Systems for Science and Technology. And they were, Japan had a chemical abstract service way back in 1930s, and the editor was still alive, and he came from Sendai down to Tokyo, and he was doing this for the abstracting services in Japanese. Most of the Japanese depended on chem abstracts, but there was also a separate Japanese under the government, the Ministry of Science, the Ministry of Education in Japan had their own JICS program, and they were trying to do it independently. And some of the commercial publishers came to us and wanted to do it for us, to set up a center based on our system. And we had a Dr. Hideaki Shihara, who is still here. I had a group since 1958 abstracting index, and actually 1955. I worked with Dr. Chihara to set up a group of abstractors in Japan under the aegis of the Japanese Chemical Society. And Chihara had a team of then only 50, but we later got it up to over 125. And I paid them to do abstracting. We paid them to do abstracting in Japan. So we are setting up an own separate organization in Japan under the Japanese Chemical Society under Dr. Chihara all these years. And the JICS was being formed. And they had a nice new building right in the heart of Tokyo there to set up their computers and all. And they were trying to build online services in the 70s. But Chihara got JICS to work together on input for us as well as output. And it was wise, and this is still underway. It's still going on now.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of this international stuff, were you making the trips, a lot of the trips yourself to these places?
At that time, a lot of them. Dr. Crane did until 1958. Well, Dr. Tate did a lot of them, working with these other countries most of the period of 60s through 75, yeah.
And you went to the Soviet Union in, what, 58 for the first time?
Yeah, 58 in the first time, but we had developed, I was one of the original starting up the National Federation of Science Abstracting and Indexing Services in America.
Right.
The Sputnik went up in 57, if you guys remember properly. And Sir Hubert Humphrey called for testimony in front of Senate as to why the Soviets could send up Sputnik and beat us. And he was the first one in Congress that was really interested. I'll never forget him. Many times we had meetings with Hubert Humphrey, but I didn't particularly think a Democrat like Hubert Humphrey would know what all he was talking about. But he took up a crusade for us in scientific abstracting. He had testimonies, we testified in front of Humphrey's hearings, and he had some people testify back then that said if we can increase the efficiency and effectiveness of our scientists and engineers 1% a year, we can overcome the backlog of the Soviet science. You may not know this, but the Soviets had set up an institute, All-Union Institute of Scientific and Technical Information, in 1952 in an old glass factory on the outskirts of Moscow, along Stalingrad Strasse. And they copied everything we did at Chem Abstract. They had taken all of our papers. They told me this many times, Mikhailov and the director. That everything we were doing, and we were right reporting, of course, what we were doing, and they took that and they integrated and established their own system. The NEDI, we called it. It was the largest, 22,000 people involved with the NEDI for all of Soviet science and technology. It's still the largest in the world, even today. The NEDI is not doing a good job now since the democratization of Russia. But one of the things we, after the hearings of Humphrey, and it really wasn't based on Sputnik, that we started to set up NFACE, the National Federation of Science Abstracting and Indexing Services, and I was one of the original members. We're just having our 40th anniversary next year. Writing the bylaws and regulations, and I was there at the meeting in Philadelphia in 1958. We were invited to go to that meeting. I was invited there, and so was Jay Crane. Jay was one of the. I want to make it clear that it wasn't Sputnik that started the Federation, however, and Dr. Burton Edkinson at NSF, and Dr. G. Miles Conrad at Biological Abstracts had gotten together the summer before in Philadelphia and said what we need in this country. That was before Sputnik, you know. And they said, let's get the abstracting services together and see whether we can't coordinate and cooperate among the abstracting services of America. And that was in February of 1958. So Miles Conrad and Atkinson called on us to send people to the meeting and to form a federation of abstracting services because we wanted to improve our services mm-hmm. to scientists. Mm-hmm. And Humphrey said, and he was probably right, I don't know that there's any data that could ever prove this, but if you do increase the information, if you get the right information to the right scientists at the right time in the right manner, they can effectively use that information. Now, millions of dollars have been spent in this country to ascertain what the uses of scientific and technical information. You see, every scientist has a wonderment in his mind when he starts a research project. He's got an idea. He thinks he wants some information to help him do his work. And then he decides that he wants to get this information at the right manner, at the right time, and he will use this, or he wants this. What is his need for information? We don't know the psychology of the human mind today, even today. Will he, what does he need? What his wants are may be entirely different than what his needs are, if this information is proper. And then what he uses, his information, is can be different too. So here are three different psychological wants, needs, and use. We've studied this in the universities and psychology and all. We don't know how that human mind, how we can pump knowledge, information to your mind tonight as you go to bed or get on your desk tomorrow, the right information that you're going to need and want and use. Okay. So this was a very important development of the Federation of Abstracting Services, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, to get together to cooperate.
That was the formation of Enphase at that point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, back to the first visit to Veneti in 58 to the Soviet Union. How did that strike you in terms of how well organized they were and how they compared with your organization?
And
were they automated at all at that point?
Your question is kind of funny. I had a man at the Library of Congress and his wife working for us during the Cold War in the 50s to get all the Soviet information through embassy mail pouches. I'd set this up with Mac Jose. Mac had been born and raised in Leningrad, so he knew the Soviet system pretty well, and so we were able to get through the embassy material. A lot of people couldn't get during the 50s under Stalin era any of the scientific and technical publications out of Moscow. So Mac had set up a plan which was very good to get our information journals out of Russia. I took Mac along, Dr. Jose, on that trip with Enphase, the five of us, along with Dr. Jose, president of Enphase. Miles Conrad was a leader of our group that time. And we had strategies developed that we would analyze and find out what they were doing at Veneti. It's very difficult in Russia especially to tell what the difference between what they had been achieving and what they were planning, what was facts and what was fiction. It's funny, the Soviets have a tendency to talk about things that they're doing rather than what they had been planning. And so it was hard, even under the best of conditions, to develop. I remember Jose and I would talk after night, or after we'd go back to our hotel rooms to see whether somebody was telling you facts, whether this was real or whether it wasn't. They had little or no automation underway in the 58 period. They had a very good Romanian Jew. He had gone to Veneti to help them do the research they needed to improve, especially in automation. And Dr. Mikhailov, who I had argued with in Washington, he'd been over to the Second International Conference at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, and we were on the same stand podium for the Second International Conference on Scientific and Technical Information. And they were developing, as I said, 2,200 people to do the abstracting, and they said over 20 fields of science and technology. Well, I argued that there weren't 20 fields, but they had developed that number of abstracting services. Mm-hmm. The referatis are now had been divided into that many fields. They had started the research program. they had developed some techniques of iron. They were using iron dots on punch card like we have, and they were very, very dots for computer reading of their punch cards, and that was kind of interesting, but they hadn't any equipment at all, any computing equipment. Even in later visits that I had over there, as far as 50 or 60s, they'd given up on that. Their generation of equipment, computing equipment, my God, it wasn't even out of the second and third generation. They had gotten some computing equipment at the Academy of Science, but it was just second and third generation. We were already in the third and fourth generation here.
They showed you these iron dots? Mm-hmm. It was a punch card with
equal to. I forget the name they called them. I still have some at home.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I brought it and I gave it back, but they were trying to do that as a method of punch card.
How were they with the science? Were they good?
Fields of science, they were ahead of us. 10%.
I don't mean general. I mean talk about in terms of indexing and abstract indexing particularly.
They were good. They were good at abstracting. They had a lot of people, as I said, 2,200 people did abstracting, and they were good at abstracting.
Did they
22,000. They had very poor indexing. This was where they never did get very good. They never have. They never will. They just didn't spend the time necessary to get quality indexing.
Hmm. And they worked out a notation system approach that was different or anything from what you all were using?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not sure I did. I gave a talk on NPACE meeting. My Conrad Award lecture was on this. I don't think they had a notation or a codum. No? They had some... No? They never had a codum notation system or notation. No?
Now, you went 58 again in 62, as I recall.
I think that's it.
It was on your resume, I think, the years that you were there. Mm-hmm. When did you first see that they had some computer-based automation in place?
Probably between 62 and 67, in that period.
Yeah. Huh.
They were hard to get, and it was all vacuum tube type of computing equipment.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty bad. The Academy of Science had it, not to the needy people. They couldn't get equipment. And the military had taken all their good computing equipment, but they had not very good generation of computing. Even the Academy of Science, where some needy guys, they had a research group.
And Mikhailov admitted that they'd been reading the papers that you all published and
trying to
copy what you were doing.
What we were doing. He admitted this many times to us in the meetings, and they were setting up a needy pattern after it's in print. After Chemical Abstract Service, they watched that very carefully.
Interesting. Before I forget, this is out of context where we are now, but the sale of dialogue, that meeting in Chicago, I don't know anything about that. Can you say a little bit more about this? And what
Lockheed was in trouble in the middle 50s, 70s. They were losing money. Lockheed, who owned Dialogue.
Well, they had not yet gone online.
Oh, yeah. Started in 72 online, Dialogue. Yeah, they'd been operating online. They kind of, I hate to tell you this, but the president of Dialogue lied at our board of directors, ACS board of directors at the Mayflower Hotel down in Washington, D.C., and he also did the same thing before Biological Abstracts board of directors. What he said, you see, back then in 72, we would lease them our tapes to provide online services. And he had charts that he showed that every time we increased our prices to him under a lease arrangement, that the number of users would decline. This was a graph that he put up in front of both biological board and our board, ACS. And it was wrong. Absolutely, it was wrong. Because Phyllis told me, the biological's abstract, and she saw the data just as we did, that actually he was trying to keep our percentage of our cost down. We started out offering him the lease of our tapes at 5% of his revenue, and then it went up to 8%, then it went up to 10%, then it went up to 25%, then it went up to 50%. He was trying to get the major share of money that he at Dialogue would take to provide the information online to break even, to meet his mm-hmm. cost. Mm-hmm. And he only wanted to pay the database producers like Biological Abstracts and CA a small percentage of the total revenue under the contracts that we had working with him. And we wanted more of the revenue. We had to. As a matter of fact, he was kind of very, very definitely trying to control the database producers.
Right. Did you see a drop in the sale of your products? Of the products that you sold directly?
What you're asking is a very critical question, and there's data to show that there is a reduced amount of use of the printed versions, yes. Mm-hmm. This went on continuously mm-hmm. throughout mm-hmm. my career, and still it's going on, of course. If people are happy and satisfied with the computer-based services, that they will stop using the printed. Mm-hmm. And that's especially true in our collective indexes.
Sure.
You can't pay $5,000, $20,000 for a printed issue unless it uses that high. And so you use a Dialogue or use Skim Abstracts STN to get the information. So, in general, you're absolutely right. The drop of the computer-based system, therefore, you have to generate the revenue from your computer-based systems more for printing. And he didn't want us to raise a percentage. He wanted to give us pittance. But also, the other thing that was critical to this development during that period was that he wanted us to tell him, or he wanted to tell us, what we put in the database and how to put it in the database so that his users were after him to get the information and all. He wanted to tell us, dictate to us how we build our database. He had nobody there as a chemist that could do the work. He finally hired one of our editors upstairs and brought him in to do the work for the chemical uses under Dialogue services out there. But those two things forced us to go in 1980 on our own mine services because we want to be able to build our database. We knew our database better than anybody else in the world. We knew what chemists wanted better than Lockheed or Dialogue. And so our Kim Amstrak's revenue was Dialogue's biggest income producer.
How did you know that?
Over 50%, because we audited his books.
Oh, he gave you the right to do that, huh?
Well, we took that right.
Okay.
We did that under the contracts. And this is where a suit was filed against us by them in the 80s, early 80s, against us for them restricting readers.
That's when you went online.
Yeah, and he wanted to get our abstracts online. We didn't give it to him, and then they decided to sue us, I think, $50 million. And after 2 years, that suit went on.
Could we stop just a minute and I'll...